Yeah, I'm losing my edge. I'm losing
Good evening.
My
this
edge.
Is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Chris DeVille, managing editor at Stereogum. And we're continuing our conversation about his book, Such Great Heights, The Complete Cultural History of the Indie Rock Explosion. Chris, welcome back to the show. It is such a pleasure to talk to you about this book. I love this book.
I really appreciate hearing that, and I feel really happy to be here.
I got to ask you, how difficult was it to assemble all the musicians and the bands and everything? I mean, did you fear that you were going to leave somebody out that was important?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely was afraid of leaving out important artists, and I'm sure I did. I was kind of in this constant battle between my desire to be completist and my editor's desire for me to have a coherent story.
I'm laughing because that's so obvious when you're dealing with a subject like this.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like there's a lot of stuff where it's like I got to make sure I mention this, both because it was important to me, or, you know, because I want to make sure that people knew that I didn't forget about it or something. But sometimes that would just devolve into like a couple of paragraphs of just like listing off band names, and then that would have to get chopped. But I'm sure there are, you know, blind spots, stuff that was happening during this time that I just like completely whiffed on. But yeah, it was definitely, it took a lot of going back through like old best of lists and old interviews, old reviews.
But I'll tell you, it was interesting, Chris, because there were a few times when you really brought it back down to your personal story. For instance, a good example, I'm going to have you talk about this. The importance to you of Vampire Weekend's Modern Vampires of the City.
Yes.
And you talk about, you know, that was a very important album to you. And that's sort of an experience that all of us experience at different parts in our life. There's going to be an album that's going to be the signature music that you're going to listen to going through that part of your life. Talk to me about Modern Vampires of the City and you.
Well, that album, yeah, it was very special to me because it was an album that found that band kind of growing up right at the time when I felt like I was growing up. It was like it came out, I believe, the year that I turned 30, the year after I got married. I hadn't started having kids yet, but it definitely felt like it was representing some sort of step forward into maturity for my whole generation, or at least my generation of, like, you know, indie music fans.
Yep.
It was cool because I always had liked and respected Vampire Weekend, but it was also an album that made me really fall in love with them as a band. They're one of those bands where you'll have people stumping for any number of their albums as the best one. Like, I don't know if there's necessarily like a consensus pick. This Modern Vampires is probably the closest thing to that, but I loved that Ezra Koenig was dealing with kind of growing older and sort of the just feeling like, oh my gosh, I'm already 30 and my youth is passing me by, and what does it mean to be, you know, to lose your youth when you've been trading off of your youth and your reputation is as this kind of like, you know, young,
yeah,
clever young,
yeah, oh, yeah,
singer-songwriter. And I loved that he was grappling with really deep subjects about even, you know, kind of the clock ticking towards death. It's like when you're 30, it probably, if you're lucky, it's a long way away when you're 30, but just the fact that he was bringing sort of this disenchantment in, and it was a little bit more personal, a little bit spiritual almost. He had been writing these songs that were so clever and sort of little character studies and crammed with references, and he continued to do that. But yeah, it just felt like it was a real sort of graduation moment for that band, and it sort of mirrored what was happening with my generation at the time.
For me, it's LCD sound systems losing my edge.
Oh, yeah.
When you get a little bit older, that song will mean a lot more to you.
Yeah, well, I'm getting up there, you know. I'm in my 40s now, and yeah, that's still... I feel like there are parts of the book that are just like, I was there.
That sounds like LCD sound system. One of the major threads that runs through the entire history is the very strange dynamic relationship between indie rock and pop.
Mm-hmm.
And their ever-changing definitions of both. I mean, you would agree, that's the story of this book.
Yeah. I mean, even the original subtitle of the book was going to be How Indie Rock Went Pop. And absolutely, like the sort of dynamic between those two forces and how they interacted with each other and how they impacted each other, that is the story of the book. And
it's a weird relationship. As you put it, indie rock blew up, spread out, and eventually ran up against a dead end. Like, explain what happens. I mean, it's a very weird story. When I think, see, I was the head of the rock department here from the late 70s into 1990. And the differences between the two of them, indie rock and pop, were clear cut. But we didn't have any of the computer. We didn't have any internet or anything. But one of the worst things to happen to a band would be to be called a pop band.
Right.
It was like the final insult. Here, it's a fluid border between the two.
Yeah, there's a few different reasons for that, I think. And trying to map out all those different reasons was a big part of the project. It was like... There was, you mentioned the internet technology that definitely broke down a lot of the borders between genres.
Yeah.
You had file sharing happening where people could download whatever music they wanted for free. You had MySpace where it's like you could just kind of click around and easily go from band to band. And something about MySpace, which is also true of file sharing and MP3s, is that music that didn't necessarily fit into an existing category could blow up. It didn't need to be selected by, a radio programmer or a TV gatekeeper or whatever. Like, it's like it could find an audience and it could blow up without having to go through some kind of gatekeeper. So that, I think, and just the whole iPod era, it really contributed to a more mix and match listening experience. You had a lot less of people who define themselves by the genre that they listen to, like I'm a metalhead, I'm a hip-hop head, or whatever. And at the same time, within music criticism, and I think this is also true of this trickled down into indie bands, or maybe it's happening side by side, was this idea of poptimism, which is like, maybe we've been rejecting certain entire genres of music for like kind of, reasons that don't hold up. Maybe, the reason that we rejected disco has to do with like biases against the audience that, popularized disco, whether that be minorities, gays, women.
I know that was a huge revelation for people who played indie music, was owning up to that.
Yeah.
It was like, that was a big deal. That was a big deal.
Right. And so it's like, suddenly, the coolest thing was to be eclectic, but not just eclectic in like a Losing My Edge LCD sound system kind of way, where, because he's being an eclectic hipster, the character he's playing on that song. He's jumping from genre to genre, but now it's like, now all of a sudden it's like, I like all that underground stuff and I also like 50 Cent. And so that kind of mentality was sort of shaping the way that indie music was developing. And then the other thing that was happening was festivals were really starting to blow up. Lollapalooza, Bonnaroo, Coachella, you had this sort of physical space where some of these genre collisions that were happening on the internet could happen in real life. And so a lot of the music started to be more catered to that festival environment where you want to appeal to as many different kinds of listeners as possible. So all those things and more of came together, and we had this dynamic where it was no longer considered anathema to be like a pop, an indie pop group. It was like suddenly those things were not considered opposing forces, even though maybe to some extent they still were. So yeah, that definitely changed the evolution of the genre. And I don't think that, like, you know, it's not like guitar bands totally went away. Like, by the time we reach the 2010s, you still have, like, bands blowing up, like Japandroids and right. Dive, that are, like, you know, playing rock, guitar-based rock music. But the thing that the zeitgeist at the time was very, like, pop-oriented. You had sort of indie-branded pop stars, and you had, even, you know, Vampire Weekend is one of several bands that was, like, trying to get away from the guys with guitars formulation, because it just seemed like it was out of style at the time.
I'll tell you, the other thing is online criticism, like where you work. I mean, that didn't exist back in the 80s. And so you would publish a zine or something, which we did. And that was the only way the word got out. Now you can canvas and cover huge amounts of territory, the world essentially, by doing and recommending or panning music. And the other thing is the end of the album. Before you had no idea, and you would buy an entire album and listen to it all the way through, and then you might pick a couple of cuts that you would play on air. Now you can just purchase or buy or sample one cut or two cuts from an album, and then screw the rest of it. And people may never hear the rest of the album because that's not what you're playing.
Yeah, and when you think, I mean, you think of the single as sort of more of a pop-based like format, and then the album as more of a, you know, rock-based format. Obviously, both the genres can go either way, but that's definitely true. I think what you said about online criticism is also really interesting in terms of, like, the death of local media. As the internet rose up, you got sort of like this global audience for some of the same media entities, and it became harder for local media to survive. And that has to do with the way that the internet evolved as well, and, like, you know, just the way traffic and advertising and everything works. I mean, it just became very difficult for local, like, alt weeklies that helped to sustain local music scenes to survive. And so that sort of changed the dynamic online as well. There's just so many different factors in play. And I thought that they were so fascinating, the way that they all interacted with each other. That was, you know, the big reason for writing the book.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Chris DeVille, managing editor at Stereogum. And we're talking about his book, Such Great Heights, The Complete Cultural History of the Indie Rock Explosion. Let's talk about a couple of artists in depth that sort of are examples of this. Let's talk about Lorde.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's a fascinating example of her royals from the Love Club. What's interesting for people like Lorde is also the criticism that comes out very quickly can affect the entire career. So let's talk about Lorde and royals. What was the problem with royals? It was declared racist.
So this is an interesting story. So you all listeners probably remember when Lorde first came out and blew up with the song Royals. She was a teenager from New Zealand. Before we talk about the controversy, I just want to point out that, like, she was sort of a part of a generation that resulted from some of the changes I was tracking in the book. And she's theoretically a pop star, but she's making this really minimalist music that kind of interacts with lots of different genres. It interacts, like, I was hearing it on the radio, on the alternative rock station, on the pop station, and even on the local, like, rap and R&B station was playing it. And so at the time, I had this high-minded idea of, like, the mono genre, like all music has finally, you know, which I think was, you know, music is always colliding and, you know, evolving and mixing and matching. So I think I maybe got out over my skis a little bit on, on that concept. But, yeah, so she was someone who was, I mean, she was a pop figure. She was getting played on the radio. She was winning Grammys. Royals was the number one song in the country. But she also had a lot of love from the indie world because she wasn't so different from these kind of indie branded pop stars that were popping up on the time and developing an audience on Tumblr or wherever. It's like there was a lot of those types of artists who were making pop music, but it was kind of alternative branded. And Lorde herself, and it's like she name checks Broken Social Scene, the Toronto indie rock band, in one of her songs. And, you know, so she was such an interesting figure that she really did represent that convergence of indie and pop. But Royals, it faced some backlash because it had this very sort of traditionally indie-minded, like anti-materialist message, but it was delivered in a way that seemed like it was specifically critiquing rappers and critiquing sort of like this young white girl critiquing like a predominantly black scene for being too materialist. So she definitely caught some backlash for that. It didn't seem to destroy her career, but it definitely was like a landmine that she had to sidestep.
I want to talk about St. Vincent. And the reason is I did a whole show dedicated to St. Vincent a couple of weeks ago. And I've yet to figure out I love her music. As you describe her as Lorde's inverse, which I think is great. St. Vincent, her career arc is wild. And I guess it sort of peaked with Mass Seduction, mm-hmm. which Pitchfork compared to Bowie's Let's Dance.
Yeah.
But she's a wild artist. I mean, she's definitely off. The more I read about her, the more I listen to her music, she's really off in a whole different direction. I don't think she really cares about anything else.
Yeah, I think that's true. She definitely seems to be, like, you know, sort of riding her own wave, especially now. But you're right. She was, because she started out as a side player for indie bands.
I know.
Like, she was in Sufjan Stevens' band when he was doing the Illinois album. And she was in the Polyphonic Spree, which was sort of like psychedelic choir out of Dallas, Texas, where she's from. And then when she first started making her solo music as St. Vincent, yeah, she was still kind of in this sort of fancy, fussy version of indie rock, sort of in there with The National and Grizzly Bear and these bands that are like making music for ornate theaters. and then album by album, she kind of moves more in a pop direction. She sort of evolves into this alternative pop star. It's interesting because she's like a guitar hero.
Oh yeah, she's wicked into guitars.
So she's got that old rock star sort of, you know, mentality. But then in the 2010s, it was like all of the rock stars were trying to become pop stars, and she definitely was part of that. I mean, she worked with Jack Antonoff as Lorde, and you know, he's another figure where it's like he works with Taylor Swift, but then he works with all of these sort of, you know, indie friendly pop stars too.
Well, I want to talk about, because you have an interesting section about Jack Antonoff. As you write, the mere mention of his name is enough to start an argument.
Mm-hmm.
I think Vice wrote, and this is from your book, Jack Antonoff makes a lot of music and none of it is good. So what's the story with Jack Antonoff? Why is he so controversial?
So Jack Antonoff is... he was a member of the band Fun that had, you know, they had in the early 2010s, they had some big hits, Some Nights and We Are Young. And after Fun broke through, he was a guitar player in Fun, and he started his own project Bleachers. It's sort of like a, you know, Springsteen worshiping indie band. But he started producing a lot around that time in the mid-2010s. And he's very controversial because the way that he was a very important figure in sort of merging the sound of pop and the sound of indie. He worked with, like I said, he worked with Taylor Swift and sort of helped her steer her sound, you know, add some sort of alternative signifiers to her sound, even as she was continuing to make the biggest pop music.
I know, it's really weird to mention indie and Taylor Swift in the same sentence.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's kind of where the whole book was heading.
I know.
But at the same time, I think that the criticism of Antonoff is that he, like, you know, sort of flattens out the sound of indie music and makes it very palatable for, like, a streaming audience, sort of a passive listening audience, makes it sound nice, takes off the rough edges. I don't know if that's always necessarily true. There's definitely been cases where, you know, he helped someone make an overly tasteful kind of album. But I like him because he's, you know, he's been a part of some albums that I really loved. You know, he was a part of Lorde's second album,
yep,
Melodrama, that was Stereogum's number one album of 2017, I want to say. And he worked on Mass Seduction with St. Vincent. He worked on with Lana Del Rey on you know, her sort of most critically acclaimed album that I don't think you can say the title on the radio. but yeah, so I feel like he's been involved in enough really cool stuff that I have a hard time just, like, outright rejecting him. But I get why he drives some people nuts, because they want, you know, they want indie music to be a little bit more jarring, a little bit more rough around the edges, a little bit less palatable for, like, you know, a corporate retail experience. And so I think that sort of his era of being, like, one of the go-to indie producers, it feels like we might have moved back away from that. I'm not really sure what his next big projects are going to be, but it feels like a lot of the big indie bands that are getting buzz right now kind of run contrary to the way that he approaches music. Because I think about a band like Geese that really blew up last year.
Yep.
They're, like, all rough edges and acquired taste, and, like, you have to actively engage with the music, not just, like, let it wash over. It's not just something that you can put on in the background on Spotify. It's not, like, algorithmic music. And
well,
so I think that's the idea with Antonoff, is that, like, he is sort of making algorithm-friendly music that you know, doesn't push you or challenge you very much.
Can you see that as a challenge, algorithmic music? I mean, I have a real fear of AI writing all this pop music, which is very a very 1984, the book.
Yeah.
A sort of fear that they sort of generate these pop musics from computers. I think that'd be so freaking weird. And that's why that sounds like a reasonable response to be indie, is to create the noise that where you have to pay attention to it, that it's not just background sounds. Although I have to admit, I love Stereolab. And that's a band that's had a career that goes over decades. They just got a new album out this year. And I just did a show about them, and I really like Stereolab, but a lot of that music is sort of trancy, and you could put it on in the background.
I think there's a difference between what they're doing and, like, sort of the Muzak style indie rock that, I mean, like, there's no doubt that, like, there was sort of the result of a lot of these changes, that sort of the glow up of indie rock and the metamorphosis of indie rock into just, like, indie minus the rock. There's definitely some Muzak quality to some of the stuff that ended up defining the genre for some people. I think we are at kind of a place where I see sort of the indie music world reacting against that sort of thing. I mean, I'm sure that there are still plenty of people making really user-friendly, smooth music and calling it indie, and maybe there's a whole listener base, a Gen Z listener
so,
base.
Easy listening indie? Is that what you're talking about? Easy listening indie?
Easy yeah. Like
E-Z listening.
Sure. I know a lot of like the new pop figures want to call themselves indie or alternative. Like there's this guy Somber. He's making a lot of hits right now. And he describes himself as an alternative artist, but he's making pop music. It's got like some callbacks to the indie music that was merging. It's like, it sounds like MGMT sometimes, or, you know, you can hear some influence of the Strokes or whatever, but it's like, it's still pop music. And so I think there is an audience, especially a younger audience, for whom that's what they think indie music is. But within like sort of the actual underground, I feel like there is more of a push towards stuff that's maybe a little bit more incongruous, a little bit more challenging, a little bit less ironing out the quirks, just letting the quirks continue to exist.
We're going to have to wind it up there, Chris, because we're out of time. Returning guest tonight, we could talk all for hours. My returning guest tonight is Chris DeVille, managing editor at Stereo Gum. And we've been continuing our conversation, and there's a thousand conversations worth in this book. Such Great Heights, The Complete Cultural History of the Indie Rock Explosion. Chris, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me and letting me go.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.
Yeah, I'm losing my edge.